Accession number 30423, reel 8.
Did you go through Brangoon itself?
Yes. Having left the salon, HMS salon, I went on a London craft and landed, climbed ashore up some muddy bank and walked into Rangoon itself. That is probably because I had to then wait for somehow to return to Anderson. I met interesting people there. I met the padre and the chaplain, which I mentioned before. The damage there was not colossal, but it was run down, sewerage, very unhealthy. I went to the Sway Dagon Pagoda with the gold dome, and we did actually take our footwear off to go in. Now, you would think a soldier would think, well, I'm doing what I want. No, it was their temple, and the Buddhist priests were still there in their saffron robes, and they indicate, take, and we did take our boots off and go in and bare feet. And I think there is a difference between us and probably Japanese. We would respect the locals. It was their country. Very impressed with the Sway Dagon Pagoda and the priests. In fact, we, up in the Pigu Road in the jungle, we camped near a temple, and we used the temple as our mess. And that's a different story than the Sway Dagon. This was just an old temple, unused, but very handy for us to use it for a billet. Particularly as the monsoon was quite severe then. Yes, Rangoon was not impressive. It's not a city as you would expect it. It was abandoned, left in a mess.
What was the period that you were in these first operations in Burma?
Sorry?
When was it that you were in Burma?
1945. How long did we stay there? Well, weeks, I suppose, at a time, because it would take three or four days to get there from Ceylon, and once you're there, you moved around. So I spent most of my time would have been ashore, except on the second naval patrol, and the only time was, if you go ashore, was to reconnoitre, research, see what you could find out. And I suppose the aim was, if there were Japanese there, if there was any use, we would stay and listen all the time. But if we found the area had been abandoned, there was nothing, there was no point staying there. And so I think it was an ad-lib operation. As things occurred, so you did it. And I think that is why we could not have a briefing. Perhaps with hindsight, we could have been briefed on what it would be like, how to survive, what we would do. That did not exist. Nor could you be briefed on exactly what to do when you got there. Because who could tell what would happen tomorrow? It was very much ad hoc, initiative, circumstances, changed. And then when that was, Dracula was finished for us, straight back to Anderson. And I suppose, meanwhile, someone else, another party, has been sent somewhere else. I think I was very fortunate to have had some interesting missions, if you call them that, because they were very, very interesting. And the last one, to find that having been trained to listen to these stations, particularly as the southern Japanese army headquarters was Saigon, to be one day to be control supervisor of that station, which you've been listening to, was quite an honour. I think it was. I can't say achievement because I didn't do it. I was given it. But I think that was a wonderful thing. And it's, I've always appreciated that I did something of interest and of use, and something I could never have dreamed of doing.
At what stage did you hear of VE Day?
VE Day. Now, I can tell you that. That was May 1944. We had left Aden. I had dengue fever. We heard the news as we were about a couple of days out at sea. We found it interesting. But there was no excitement. I'm afraid for us it was, I won't say a non-starter, but it was of interest. But we knew that we've taken no part in it, we were not there, and we had something else to do, and the Japanese war was still on. So really, we could not say we celebrated it. We didn't have a tot on it, or splice the main brace, or anything special. It was just of interest. Knowing now the importance of what had really happened, if we'd have known the truth, the full story, it would have been interesting, but it was just...
And when it came to being posted on the Indochina mission, had you been briefed as to the situation, the political situation?
We have been... The briefing consisted of, you are specialists, you're going, we hope, after you form yourself in Burma with this surrender into Indochina. We were shown a big map. We were shown the route we would take, all being well. We were then individually told our responsibilities. We were not told that there could be an Annamite uprising. We were told it was a French colony, that we were simply going there as a control mission to take the surrender of the Japanese, to protect the security of the area and its people, law and order. That completed our briefing. We were not told that Ho Chi Minh had been supplied and himself believed that he would get help to take over. We knew none of those things. We simply knew a control commission to establish law and order and take over until the French would take over from us and it would become a French colony again. But that was not emphasized. It was not a question that we were going to protect French interests we're going to protect the country and mainly uppermost in our mind to take over from the Japanese.
What sort of state was Saigon in when you arrived?
The Tansen Airport was in a bit of a mess with wrecked aircraft, but fully operational for landings. Transport was running. I would say the city itself was running as if there'd been no war on. They had the markets, the shops, the hotels, albeit under strict Kempeitai domination, strict control. But it was under control. There was no damage. It was a city, fully operational. There, of course, the French had collaborated in the early stages, but there had come a time, some short time before, when the Japanese really clamped down, and quite a number of the French were soldiers were interned. I became friendly with one and his family, but they were living a normal life. It wasn't a question of taking over a battle-torn, war-torn city or devastation. It's fully operational.
What sort of reception did you get from the civilian population?
Oh, from the French. We were welcomed, yes, made very welcome. As individuals, I'm not so sure about the political scene, because the political scene was difficult. You had the Indo-Chinese who wanted to have their way, you had the French who wanted to get their colony back again. So I think there was a strained atmosphere which we could sense. We could sense that. But as a French family to a soldier, very friendly, very helpful. But on the outside, a tense feeling. But of course, it was so quick, the uprising after we arrived, there wasn't much time to say, oh, this is peacetime, because we were back into a guerrilla warfare again situation. The uprising was much larger than I think was understood back in UK, because the arms would be carried, say, by a woman in a fruit basket on her head. You could take it inside Saigon, the grenades. Arms were there. They were using Japanese equipment, American equipment, stuff they had obviously taken from Singapore, perhaps British equipment. So they were quite powerful against our small group. So when you say, what sort of reception do we have? Well, the reception, being peaceful, only lasted a matter of days, because you were right back into a war situation. And mistrust. Who could you trust?
You mentioned that when the uprising began on the 16th, around about the 16th, that a lot of the French civilians were killed.
Yes, they were.
Directed only against the French or anyone?
They were in the majority. Our control commission were in situ. Those that were in their buildings, those who were in administration, were in their buildings they'd taken over. So the attack was against the French population rather than the British, although, of course, we had to retaliate, and they would retaliate in that respect. But it wasn't a war between the British and the Annamites. It was a question of trying to protect the others, and you would get involved. So the Annamites were against the French. They wanted control of Saigon. They wanted their government. So we were, I suppose, really, to simplify, we could have withdrawn, gone into our fortress and sat it out and let them get on with it. And we wouldn't be involved. But of course, that could not happen. We were there to take over. And so we become involved. Now, when I mentioned about the village we had to eliminate, that was a centre point of the Annamites. So we become involved. This is one of the problems. I know that there's been arguments whether we acted correctly in the French interest, whether we became too involved. But I come back to the simple fact. We are there. There are problems. There are killings. You have to retaliate to protect not just the others, but yourself. Now, if I take the wireless station, I suppose they might well have loved to have had that. I don't think it's in their agenda, but although it was attacked, I don't think they really wanted it as a wireless station. It was just a place where there were troops. So you get attacked. Now, we could have said, well, nothing to do with us. Let them get on with it. And I think historians must take that into consideration. We were there, the British. The country was up in arms against colonial rule. We had to defend the local population, the town, the city, the area. And to do so, you must defend. Again, I know Gracie was criticized, but I come back to the simple statement. How can you protect and maintain law and order? And in doing so, then get blamed. Of course, at the very end, the second DB came Leclerc, General Leclerc. The French moved in. The Richelieu ship came, the French sailors, Frenchmen, they took over. And I think I was probably one of the very, very last to leave. So I saw the takeover from us by the French. I have no idea who took over the radio station, none at all. But I know they took over the running of the city as we left.
You mentioned before that some of the Japanese were pressed back into service. Were there reservations about that?
Yes. I think some years ago, I remember reading a denial that that had happened. And I was a bit mystified because I knew it did. Now, it wasn't a general rearming of the entire Japanese army as such, but the Japanese were put back into guarding installations. You can only guard if you're armed. You had to have control points on roads. Again, you can only control them if they're armed. We were very limited in the very early stage. Now, as the weeks went by, a great amount of troops, aircraft, ships came. But at the very early stages, very little. So it was necessary to decide what areas needed protecting, who should do what, and to do it, they were rearmed. Now, with the Royal Station, yes. I had taken personal control of the surrender of their weapons. They were put into store. So rifles, bayonets, ammunition were reissued to a number of Japanese. There'd be sentries on the gate to patrol the perimeter. Limited, but they were rearmed. I have no idea how much they were used. I do not think any of my group ever fired a shot. Anything that was done by our little group of Gurkhas with myself. And that was limited anyway, except on that little skirmish at one time outside. And that was only because we'd gone out to see what was, who were shooting at us. Again, I understand Gracie had issued the order to rearm Japanese. Again, I think that met with some raised eyebrows. I cannot say anybody ordered me to do it. I have no idea. I do not remember. I could well have done it myself. It's hard to say. Because I don't think you would take that initiative to start a private war. So there must have been some order somewhere that I do not remember.
Did you have any idea about how the Japanese felt about that?
No. They were under orders. The Japanese, from the very first moment I got there, were subservient. Completely. They, what they felt inside of themselves, difficult, but they were outwardly morally destroyed. They were now disgraced. And so they bowed, they scraped, they did as they were told. So I'm quite sure when you gave them their arms back, they did not feel, we're useful again. They were doing what they were told to do. Now, whether they would have, on the bottom line, fought with us a battle, I have severe doubts. Because a number of Japanese had not surrendered in Indochina, and they'd gone with their weapons and arms into the uprising. Now, the amount, I don't know, but I know some had, and there were units out there that were supporting the uprising. Only historians can tell you that now, but I knew there were some. But my Japanese were simply doing as they were told.
And they always showed respect towards the British troops.
They showed respect, but not in the European civilized idea of respect, where you respect someone for what they are. Their respect was because they were disgraced and knew that they were worthless and you were now the victor. So the word respect has a different meaning as far as the Japanese is concerned. Every time I must come back to what made the Japanese tick, and it was simply the blind belief in their emperor, the blind belief that they would give their life. And if they were killed, perhaps their ashes would go back to Japan, to the temple. But and they would fight, be ferocious. They would put up with malnutrition, beriberi. a number of my people in the United States had beriberi. I can only think they had come down from Burma, because they would never have got into that health situation by being in Indochina. And, but they accepted it. And that's why they could be such a vicious, unforgiving enemy. It's only when they became prisoners that the curtain came down, they were nobody. The British soldier never made use of that. They did not kick the down. Had he been defeated, that's it, he's Japanese. They're not going to like him. They're not going to forgive him. But we are now in charge. They will do as they're told. I think that's a British mentality, a soldier's mentality. The Gurkhas, they detested the Japanese, and quite understandably why. But again, they did not take it out on anyone. They treated them, that was a defeated soldier. And I've no idea, it'd be interesting to ask what a British soldier thought of the Germans or Italians. But I can only say, I got to know the Japanese simply because I spent so much time, months with them, that I began to see what made them tick. Very clever people, actually. Very clever people. But they've been brainwashed through the centuries into the Bushido code, and that's what they believed in. And until you understood that, you could never really fight them or beat them. Learn your enemy. Learn his mentality. Because you could then think what he's going to do next, what he might do. Well, having known what the Japanese were like, I knew that I was safe with them. They weren't going to stab me in the back. They could, I'm there amongst all this lot. They could get rid of me and never be seen again. I knew that would happen. Because that is not their code.
You mentioned the Gurkhas earlier. Did you have much experience with the Indian soldier?
Yes, we had, in between having the Gurkhas, I had Jats, J-A-T. They were northern Indians. The comparison, with no disrespect to the Indian, you could like to understand their way of life, again, more inclined to peace than war. For Gurkha as a soldier, I give 10 out of 10. For the Indian Jat, I give 4 out of 10. Simply because he wasn't really too keen on the fighting. He'd rather go home. But as a person, again, I'm talking as a fighting soldier, as a person, they're lovely people. They're charming, they're interesting, the way of life. They're very, again, you'll find them quite deep thinking and quite intelligent for their way of life and respect for their way of life. But they'd be more interested in being an Indian. They came, of course, you look at the partition when it came with Pakistan, Bangladesh, India. They're divided amongst themselves. So my group would have been Hillman, not the city, not the Indian, not the Sun Indian type. These would have been, I think, basically country Hillman soldiers. By the way, I mentioned yesterday, with Bombay. It was the gateway of India we always landed at. I mentioned King George's, it wasn't the gateway of India.